The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, where you've been able to follow developments around the world every afternoon on All Things Considered for more than 32 years. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, November 13th, 2017. Ahead on today's show, a successful public transit system requires many things: frequency, dependability, speed, and reliability. Tonight, an expert in public transit, Jarrett Walker, helps the Northwest Arkansas Regional Planning Commission begin a new speaker series about mobility in Northwest Arkansas. We talked to him before his arrival, and we'll hear part of that conversation later on today's Ozarks at Large. First, Highland Pellets in Pine Bluff, in operation for almost a year now, is chipping plantation-grown southern pine into wood pellets to fuel a surging European utility market sourcing green biomass. The new $229 million facility is just one of a growing fleet of prosperous industrial pellet mills across the southeastern United States, which claim to operate sustainably. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich discovered, not all pellet mills are equal.
Every day, 120 logging trucks, each carrying a 28-ton load of 50-foot-long southern yellow pine, roll into Highland Pellets, the 200-acre industrial wood pellet mill, the first in Arkansas, which opened in December, has been building steam ever since. A giant crane grapples entire truckloads of logs, dropping the wood into a long horizontal tumbler called a drum debarker. Flailed logs are fed via chain conveyor into a massive chipper. Wearing required safety gear, Jody Doak, Highland Plant Manager, guides us through the process.
113-inch chipper. It's got 24 knives on it, and these knives rotate driven by two 1,200 horsepower motors, and they basically shave the logs down into microchips.
The noise is deafening. Doak says the chipper produces 230 metric tons of wood chips per hour, piled by an aerial conveyor into huge fragrant mountains nearby. Next, the chips are pushed through dryers fueled by waste bark, hammered into rough sawdust, then extruded through one of five pellet mills on site. Doak grabs a handful of pellets.
They're still hot from the extrusion process, so we ship them up to coolers, which blows ambient air across them to help cool them. After that, they're collected on this conveyor where each line dumps its pellets onto the same conveyor, which heads up to our storage silos. We have five chief bins. Each one is capable of holding 1,000 metric tons of pellets.
Pellets are shipped by rail 400 miles south to the port of Greater Baton Rouge, where they are loaded into storage domes owned by Drax Group. The electrical utility in England has converted several coal-fired plants to biomass. It ships all the pellets overseas to its port in England. The United Kingdom and the European Union have set a policy goal to produce 20% of electricity from renewable resources by 2020. Spurring a new American wood pellet industry over the past decade. Concentrated along the eastern seaboard, plants have also been built in North Carolina, Mississippi, Florida, Georgia, and Louisiana, where mills are grinding mostly mature hardwood forests into more than 9 million metric tons of export wood pellets annually. Tom Riley, chairman of Highland Pellets in Arkansas, he's headquartered in Boston, Massachusetts, says he plans to expand operations in this state, as well as into Mississippi and Maine, citing an emerging Japanese market. But compared to other U.S. pellet mills, Riley says, he sources 70% of his feedstock from immature southern pine, much of it row-cropped, on commercial plantations in South Arkansas, which is harvested full-grown for lumber and pulp.
And as those trees grow, for two reasons, you thin them. One is for interim cash flow to support that whole life cycle of that growing of that crop. But you're also thinning that forest to allow light to reach those trees and nutrients to reach the ground such that those trees continue to grow, and you have a first thinnings in 12 to 14 years, a second thinning in 18 to 20 years, and then you harvest for sawlogs in 18 to 32 years.
The Highland Mill also sources pine sawlog, treetops, and sawmill waste, all of which makes for super sustainable fuel, he says.
So the moment you're burning a pellet in the UK, you're sequestering that carbon on the other side. That's fact. That's indisputable fact.
The UK and EU classify woody biomass as carbon neutral because trees grow back, capturing CO2. We queried Arkansas Sierra Club and several other state environmental groups about this simple equation. None could comment, saying they were unfamiliar with Arkansas's new wood pellet industry. But Sasha Stashwick, an energy expert with Natural Resources Defense Council, headquartered in New York, has been closely monitoring the U.S. pellet mill industry over the past decade.
Wood is a less energy-dense fuel than coal, so you have to burn a lot more of it to produce the same amount of electricity. So at the smokestack, you're actually emitting more carbon into the atmosphere.
Stashwick says pellet mill harvested native forests in the southeast, replanted with saplings today, won't be enough to sequester all that new carbon. Pellet mills must comply with state regulators, but no federal policy on U.S. biomass exists. So to quell public concern, the industry has established best management practices. For example, the Sustainable Biomass Program.
From the start, this is a certification scheme that has been dominated by industry. It's built using a self-policing approach where companies really, you know, police themselves. And what we see is that it's resulted in increased carbon emissions, accelerated loss of natural forests.
Stashwick says sustainable sourcing standards alone are insufficient, given global utilities lack any real carbon accounting for burning wood pellet fuel.
Because right now, these power plants that burn wood pellets, they're not accountable for their carbon emissions. They don't have to count that carbon. And really, that carbon is real. It's being emitted to the atmosphere, and it's driving climate change.
NRDC is mapping pellet mill harvesting to document logging practices on forests, 90% of which in the southeast are privately held. NRDC has zero tolerance for industrial pellet mills, but the Southern Environmental Law Center, which is also monitoring the industry, is calling for standards to restrict the use of whole living trees and the conversion of logged natural forests to monocropped tree farms. America's native forests, the Law Center says, are critical carbon sinks, absorbing 12% of all U.S. carbon dioxide emissions. Ironically, wood pellet biomass has yet to be widely sourced by U.S. power companies, which have been switching from coal to natural gas, currently plentiful. Bob Apt, a professor of forest economics at North Carolina State University at Raleigh, who models the U.S. forest product supply chain for industry, academia, and environmental groups, says Highland Pellets appears to be an industry outlier because, again, it almost exclusively sources commercially grown pine.
Pine plantations have an advantage in a couple of ways. One is those trees are very fast growing and they're managed intensively. The other is no landowner plants a pine plantation without the expectation of harvesting it. So the future of those trees is what plant they would end up at, not whether they would be harvested or not.
Apt, who's served on EPA's Science Advisory Board on Bioenergy, classifies wood pellets as a cleaner fuel option, but not carbon neutral.
I can only come up with extreme scenarios where it would be even close to as bad as coal, but it also takes very many rosy assumptions for it to come out carbon neutral.
Given rising global demand for wood pellets, Apt believes it will serve as a transitional fuel this century as the clean energy sector develops. But current demand could likely encourage more tree farming of fallow land, he says, which in turn could sequester more carbon.
People grow corn. I grow pine trees.
Commercial timber owner and logger Bobby Taylor stands next to Highland Pellets truck weigh station. He's a third-generation southern pine forester, one of several local tree farmers, he says, contracted to supply 250,000 tons of logs to Highland Mill annually. He welcomes the wood pellet industry to town, given the forecast for southern pine profits remains dismal.
We're growing so many pine trees in Arkansas that we needed somewhere else to take them. So this has really been a huge thing for our industry.
Subtropical, coniferous, and temperate deciduous forests, which cover more than half of Arkansas, are often referred to by industry insiders as valuable wood baskets. And most of that forest is privately held by individuals and corporations. The U.S. has dozens of federal laws and incentives targeting things like biodiesel crops and natural gas vehicles. But with no federal biomass policies yet in place or state laws, any number of Arkansas wood baskets could get carried away. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums, and it's time for a Monday visit with Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics. You can read many articles, keep up with the day's news in Arkansas on both business and politics at talkbusiness.net. But one thing, Michael, first of all, welcome to the Monday program.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Sometimes I start talking, I never stop. One thing we rarely talk about is that there's also opinion at talkbusiness.net, and you say this latest one from Stacey Mason about skills for the future has generated some interest. Tell me about this.
Yeah, it's generated some interest, and it caught my attention, too, in terms of kind of a aha moment. And it's really something I think we all know instinctively, but it's nice to be reminded from time to time. But Stacey Mason, she owns Mason on Leadership. It's a leadership consultancy business based in Bentonville. But she wrote this opinion about skills for the future. And, you know, obviously, you know, Governor Asa Hutchinson has put coding in the schools, computer coding. That's a big thing. STEM courses, science, technology, electronics and math. You know, that's the big thing. But she really focused in on the skills also require future workers to be productive, a collaborative part of the workforce. And so she offered several tips that, in fact, I've emailed out to folks, you know, in the human resource world, school board members, that type of thing. I thought her points were great. So I'm going to quickly run through these. Stop me, get any questions. But she said students, and this is at the high school and college level for even her workforce, and really even after, if you want to improve your soft skills. But she encourages students to be immersed in the arts and humanities, to study religion, philosophy, art, you know, photography, design, dance, theater, those type of things, creative writing. And then her point was, and I'm going to quote her, the idea is to see the world and your place in it through a different lens. I thought that was interesting. And she talked about building divergent competencies by taking classes in human resources, and she even mentions journalism, God forbid, but, you know, build competencies in anthropology, criminal justice, and those type of things. She said in there, with that, you learn to debate the toughest questions from multiple angles, you know, it adds perspective and context. And then she talked about to increase knowledge in the realm of behavioral understanding, you know. And she even mentioned to listen to TED Talks. I know, Kyle, you've given at least one of those, so you understand how those can be interesting and informative. But her point was to try to understand how others tick and how that drives human connectivity. I just thought that was interesting. And then some employers, and me being an employer also, I mean, I especially like this, but she encourages people to take a sabbatical.
Yeah.
You know, try to find a way to, you know, get out of the, what she called the hypervigilant, you know, environment of a workforce and, you know, disconnect from the world and take a sabbatical. Now, that doesn't have to be 6 months or a year, but, you know, go disconnect. Then her last point, which I thought was very interesting, and I'm sure my friend Matt Campbell would appreciate this, was she said to brave an improvisation class, which I'm not going to, I know most of your listeners understand what that is, but she said it's a great way to learn what she called the powerful competence of reframing. And if you've been in an improvisation class, which I did in college 1,000 years ago, but it really forces your mind to work quickly and make connections, and it's a good mental exercise. And anyway, those are the points she laid out, and again, I just think those are, to me, soft skills. You can be the best mathematician or computer coder in the world, but if you don't know how to work with people and you don't know the world around you, you're going to be a pretty poor employee.
Well, and, you know, to my eyes, when I read this, and to your ears when I heard you going down the list, these all make incredible sense. It's about being well-rounded. It's about that liberal education with a lowercase L.
Yes, but unfortunately, and I see it in school districts. I see them moving away from these soft skills toward these STEM classes because that's what Little Rock requires. Little Rock requires students to have X amount of this and X amount of that. And when school districts run into funding challenges or teacher shortages, guess which classes get cut first? These soft skills. They're always on the low end of the priority list. And I think if there's any education officials or legislators listening, I would hope they would try to think through that a little bit better.
Well, I know you're an employer, but you're also kind of an employee of Talk Business, of your own place. What do you think when you hear, for you, take a sabbatical? Because, Michael, when was the last time you took any amount of time off?
Well, now you're starting to sound like my wife.
Well, or mine, or yeah. Countless husbands and wives around this region.
Yeah, well, that's a great point, and I probably need to now. I'm sure Roby Brock would kill me if I took a sabbatical. But,
well, Roby is one that, I mean, he needs to do, I mean.
Yeah, we both need to, but now I've taken maybe many sabbaticals, but the problem is I take a laptop with me.
Right.
So I'm still connected, but I could definitely benefit from sabbatical as could Kyle Kellums.
I'm guilty as charged. It's hypocrisy on my part. I admit that. All right. Well, let's take at least a break for a few days, not from work, but from talking to each other, and you'll be back on Friday. How's that?
That works. I appreciate that.
You can see this Stacey Mason opinion piece and much more at talkbusiness.net around the clock. Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome, sir.
It has been more than a month since Hurricane Maria hit the island of Puerto Rico. And the ongoing crisis is not just about the lack of power and clean water. It's also affecting the mental health of many Puerto Ricans.
Are you safe? Yes. Are you okay? That's a different question.
I'm Kelly McEvers, addressing mental health needs in Puerto Rico this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From 3 to 6 today on 91.3. A few numbers to consider now. $2 million. That's the amount in dollars of a planned gift from University of Arkansas alumni Ted and Leslie Belden to Campaign Arkansas. University of Arkansas officials say the gift will create the Cyrus A. and Martha Sutherland Endowed Chair in Preservation Design in the university's Faye Jones School of Architecture. It will also create the Sam Smith Endowed Care Scholarship for first-generation students at the university, and it will also help create the Roland Sales Endowment in Student Athlete Development. Another number associated with this, $1 billion. That's the amount, again in dollars, that is the fundraising goal of the Arkansas campaign. 1. The number of official Arkansas cooking vessels, and that official cooking vessel is, as designated by the Arkansas legislature, the Dutch Oven. Saturday, Hobbs State Park will host a Dutch oven workshop at the park's visitor center in Benton County on Highway 12, just east of the Highway 12 War Eagle Road intersection. Registration is $40. Participants will learn how to cook a three-course meal during the four-hour session from 10 until 2 on Saturday. You can learn much more and register at 789-5000. 5. The number of kilometers covered in the Jingle Bell Jog 5K and Reindeer Fun Run at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks early next month. The 5K will start at 9 a.m. on Saturday, December 2nd, and the Fun Run, for runners under age 12, is an hour later at the Botanical Garden. More details at bgozarks.org. And just ahead on Ozarks, thoughts about public transit in Northwest Arkansas. Friday, we talked with Jarrett Walker, the first guest speaker in a new series of talks about mobility in the region. It's being sponsored by the Northwest Arkansas Regional Planning Commission. That's in about 30 seconds on Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Additional support provided by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include American College of Radiology certified imaging departments, infusion centers, pharmacy, clinical trials, and more. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com.
The Northwest Arkansas Regional Planning Commission wants Northwest Arkansas residents to think a bit more about public transit. Tonight, the commission launches a new speaker series, Growing Mobility for a Growing Region. It will take place at Record Downtown in Bentonville beginning at 6:30. The first speaker tonight, Jarrett Walker. He's the author of Human Transit, How Clearer Thinking About Public Transit Can Enrich Our Communities and Our Lives. He is a full-time transit consultant and a president at Jarrett Walker & Associates in Portland, Oregon. In the first few pages of his book, he writes, public transit is often supported in communities. He describes that support as wide but shallow. Jarrett Walker says he means that a problem with public transit is not so much opposition, but apathy.
And there's a lot of broad general support for public transit. But the challenge is that it's difficult to turn that broad support towards specific plans that do specific things, because there's not very much understanding out there of what kinds of transit achieve what kinds of things. You can compare this to how roads work. You know, everybody knows how roads work. I don't have to explain what a left turn pocket is when I'm talking about a road, right? Because everyone knows. But there's corresponding amount of stuff to know about transit that most people just haven't stopped to think about.
In his book, Walker breaks down some of the transit issues he thinks are misunderstood, speed and frequency, two such categories. He says many people demand speed, the ability to get where they're going on a bus or train in a hurry. He says that's understandable for a commuter who primarily travels by car, but he counters that frequency is far more important.
And as a result, you know, we get lines that are fast, but that are never coming when you need them, or just not coming often enough to be relevant. That's a common problem with commuter rail, for example, you know, which tends to mean, you know, service that's very fast, but not very frequent.
Then there is cost. Conversations, news articles, municipal plans often center around the startup cost of a new transit system. Millions here, or for a larger system covering more ground, billions of dollars. Walker says a trickier problem for a sustainable transit system is something he again thinks is often misunderstood, operating costs.
This is a problem when people who are coming from infrastructure professions, which includes not just road building, but also architecture and development, you know, and a lot of the people who initially care about transit are in those categories. And they're coming from professions where it's about building something. And once the thing is built, its operating cost is pretty low, right? That's what a road is. That's what a building is. The cost is mostly in the capital and the construction. The operating cost of a road is pretty low. Transit is totally different. Transit is mostly operating cost. And so the most common mistake we see in transit planning is building infrastructure in ways that are not optimally building infrastructure in ways that make it difficult to operate.
Sometimes those problems that make a transit system difficult to operate develop because somewhere in the planning process, priorities might have shifted. There can be, understandably, he says, desire to make sure the transit system is pretty and will look good on a city brochure. But other elements might be ignored that can make the transit system problematic. He says there's a textbook example in one Oregon town. The city created a bus hub that is LED certified, beautiful, and everything a city would crave in a physical transit center, except
the buses can't turn left out of it. They can only turn right. And as a result, all of the buses have to drive in circles for about 5 minutes to get pointed in the direction that they're going.
In the book, Human Transit, How Clearer Thinking About Public Transit Can Enrich Our Communities and Our Lives, Walker lists seven demands consumers often bring to a discussion about public transit. The demands include those of geography and time. When can I ride? Where can I go? And also a value and safety. But he writes, trust and freedom are incredibly important to get consumer buy-in. He writes that when limited transit schedules interfere with people's lives, forcing them, for example, to decline a last-minute dinner invitation or cut short the family's day on an outing, we can see why transit is not the choice for more trips. With all of this information, with the rights and wrongs other cities and regions have committed building transit systems, does Northwest Arkansas have an advantage by being later to the game for a major transportation grid? Jarrett Walker says there are advantages, not the least of which is just having a better idea of how to talk about what might come later.
There's a lot of experience now about how to get transit systems going in small cities, not just the technical part, but also just what kind of conversations need to happen, what kind of decisions need to be made, what kind of questions do people have to think about when they're putting this together. And, you know, some of these are policy questions, like, is the goal of the system high ridership, or is the goal of the system to have a little bit of service everywhere for everyone? Right? Those happen to be opposite goals. A high ridership network is one that focuses high-frequency service intently on the places of highest demand and doesn't serve low-demand places. So you have to have, but that tends to collide with other goals, like, you know, people want it spread out. They want a little bit of something in every city, things like that. So you have a lot of difficult decisions to make, and the profession, I think, is getting smarter about how to make those, how to sort of structure those conversations and make sure that you're putting in a system that actually reflects your community's value.
Walker says in Northwest Arkansas, success of any future system will depend on the robustness of two major city areas.
So downtown Fayetteville plus the university, downtown Bentonville, some of the others, those are going to be your best transit markets. And the strength of those centers, for example, the fact that the new Walmart headquarters is going in very close to downtown Bentonville, those are some of the key things that would make me optimistic about your region.
If there is an expanded transit system in Northwest Arkansas's future, one that would expand on services already provided by Ozark Regional Transit or the University of Arkansas, several different entities will be involved. It would include four, at least, major cities and stretch across two different counties, meaning several governments will have a role. Can too many chefs in the transit kitchen spoil the recipe?
You bet it can be a problem. And what tends to happen, there are a bunch of ways this can work, but usually you're going to need some kind of two-county transit authority that generally has a board of directors that contains city councilors in the various cities and county commissioners and whatever you need to put together. And they also need, of course, some kind of funding source. But then there are important roles still for municipal government. And it always continues to need to be a partnership with municipal government. In many regions, there is a regional transit system that connects the cities to each other, but municipal governments, city governments also do their own things locally, you know, have their own shuttle services or whatever.
Jarrett Walker is the author of Human Transit, How Clearer Thinking About Public Transit Can Enrich Our Communities and Our Lives. He is a full-time transit consultant and president at Jarrett Walker & Associates in Portland, Oregon. He is the first speaker in the new series, Growing Mobility for a Growing Region. He'll talk tonight at Record Downtown in Bentonville. The series is sponsored by the Northwest Arkansas Regional Planning Commission. His talk tonight begins at 6:30, and Record Downtown is at 14 Southwest A Street in Bentonville.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. A month and a half after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, drinkable water is still hard to find.
90% of the people get their water from these little cheap PVC pipes. This one is pouring directly off the side of the mountain into a 5-gallon bucket.
But in an isolated part of the island, one team of soldiers is trying to help. That's next time on Here and Now.
Beginning this afternoon at 1 on 91.3. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Governor Asa Hutchinson is back in Arkansas after a trade-based trip to China and Japan. Mike Preston, the executive director of the Arkansas Economic Development Commission, also made that trip. He says the trip was about building relationships with the two countries and says Japan has had a significant economic relationship with Arkansas for several years. China is a relatively new market for trade.
You know, we went there, and really it's about relationships. It's building these relationships. It's building the trust with these two countries to make sure that they're confident in the investments that they've already made here, and then looking for future investments. If you look at Japan, it's our largest foreign direct investment from any country, and China's a new market for us. You know, we've been very successful the last couple of years, 5 projects, $1.5 billion in investment, over about 1,600 jobs total. Our focus in going there again was to, you know, reemphasize these relationships that we have.
Preston says the Arkansas delegation is also working on a few new relationships, but he's not ready to discuss them just yet. He made his comments to Roby Brock of Talk Business and Politics yesterday. The Rogers City Council is canceling the western portion of an annexation election scheduled for November 14th. The annexation election concerned land between Highway 112 and Heifel, and the cancellation comes after Bentonville approved a voluntary annexation of about 40 properties inside that area. Rogers leaders say that created a situation making providing city services nearly impossible for the area. The annexation election will continue, however, for smaller plots of land east of Highway 112. The city of Cave Springs is also holding a special election next month to annex the same piece of land west of Highway 112 that Rogers had proposed to annex. Drivers using Highway 265 between Mountain Road and Randall Wobey Lane in Springdale will be diverted into single lanes for a week at least, beginning today, because of daytime work by Springdale Utilities and nighttime work by the Arkansas Department of Transportation. That work is expected to last through Friday. An update now. As Arkansas Public Media previously reported on Ozarks at Large, burning farm fields after the harvest is an air quality issue that's pitted farmers against residents and at least one doctor. Now, as Ann Kenda reports, rice industry leaders are forming a task force to look into it.
Ag burning season is mostly over now, but the controversy flares up every fall when rice farmers do quick flash burns to clear residue and get the land ready for the next season. Some asthma sufferers say the smoke makes their symptoms much worse. Now, a task force to be formed by the Arkansas Rice Farmers Board will consider whether a smoke management model already in place for forest landowners would work for rice farmers. State Agriculture Department spokesperson Adrian Barnes says now is a teachable moment.
What conditions you shouldn't burn in terms of humidity levels and wind direction and wind speed. It can also help educate folks about how many people should be burning at once. There are times when the airship would be considered full and farmers might need to wait a few hours or an extra day to burn so that they're not all actually burning at once.
The smoke guidelines will be voluntary, but Arkansas Agriculture Secretary Wes Ward says there'll be a lot of interest in cooperating.
I don't think you'll find one farmer anywhere that's doing something on purpose to be a nuisance to their neighbors or to, you know, have a negative impact on anybody. So I think we're all generally throughout the agriculture industry trying to find solutions that work for everybody and trying to be good neighbors and find better ways of doing things.
Dr. Warren Skog, a pediatrician in Jonesboro who's been concerned about the effects of ag smoke on his young patients, welcomes the news.
I'm so pleased that they took this on and that they're working on a solution that may not be the entire solution, but it has the potential to truly help here.
Skog takes air quality readings every afternoon. He says they've been much better since field burning season ended. I'm Ann Kenda with Arkansas Public Media.
Arkansas Public Media is a journalism collaborative of Arkansas's public radio stations and funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You can learn more at the Arkansas Public Media Facebook page or arkansaspublicmedia.org.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Theater Squared Gala is set for November 16th at 6 p.m. at the Fayetteville Town Center, supporting education and access programs for 25,000 Arkansans. This year, the gala features singer and actor Liz Calloway, a Tony nominee and Emmy winner, in a cabaret performance, plus the presentation of the Arts Advocate Award to Nick and Carolyn Cole. Tickets, tables, and information at 445-6333 or theater2.org.
It is November 13th, 2017. This is Ozarks at Large. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
Have I mentioned I've done like five or six Christmas interviews already?
You did mention that, yes.
All right, we're going to talk about art.
All right.
There's a cool art show that's happening at Art Ventures, which most of you probably will call the underground for the rest of our lives.
It's the former Fayetteville Underground.
It is.
Still on the corner of the square.
But we in Arkansas like to say, you know, the underground.
Where the Woolworths used to be.
Or 6th Street, or where the Woolworths used to be. The show is called the Illinois River Salon. And it's put together by the Heart of America Artists Association in cooperation with the Illinois River Watershed Project. This is the 5th year, but probably you've never seen it, because the show happened. There was one night at a banquet for the Illinois River Watershed Project.
So if you weren't at the banquet, you didn't see it that year.
And then it was hung at the Illinois River Watershed Learning Center in Cave Springs,
which is a wonderful facility.
But you probably never saw it. So this year, it's at Art Ventures. It's 41 artists, over 60 pieces of art. And it's not just landscapes that show the river. It's everything.
Everything in the watershed.
That happens in the watershed. Julie Hayes, who I talked to for the story, she's the president of the Heart of America Artists Association, has this beautiful heron that's part of the show for her. Gorgeous stuff. Much of it for sale. And on Thursday night, you can go and you can see all of the art and meet all these people from 6 to 8 p.m. at Art Ventures and buy something wonderful for Christmas.
There, see?
Yeah. Also this week, sandwiched in at the Shiloh Museum on Wednesday is UA Professor Frank Scheid talking about Charlie Chaplin in Northwest Arkansas.
That's free.
This happens at noon. It's so much fun. On Thursday, there's a book signing with Evan Demorel.
Evan Demorel.
Thank you. I knew I was going to mess it up, but I knew you'd fix it, who is the author of African American Athletes in Arkansas. That happens at 5 o'clock at the Fort Smith Museum of History. Mm-hmm. There's also on Thursday, Ruckus for the River.
Yeah.
Which is a fundraiser for the Ozark River Stewards and the Buffalo River Watershed Alliance. Happens from 6:30 to 9 at Bear's Place with a folk rock trio called Jigsaw. And Van Buren High School is doing the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee.
Oh, that's a fun show.
That happens at 7 o'clock through the 18th, 16th through the 18th, at the Van Buren Fine Arts Center, which is a thing of beauty, and tickets are $10.
Ever been in a spelling bee?
Yes. I know what word I couldn't spell, too.
You remember it?
Oh, yeah.
What was it?
Spatula.
I'll give you that.
Can you spell spatula?
Let me see. S-P-A-T-U-L-A?
Correct.
Well, there you go.
And now you've learned something today.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
During times of crisis or natural disaster, you need to know the latest and most reliable information. KUAF is your source of this information. Morning Edition and All Things Considered, Here and Now and Ozarks at Large, plus hourly newscasts, bring you news throughout the day and night. The news is here when you need it, but only because of support from our listeners. Your gift makes sure the reliable, need-to-know information on KUAF stays exactly where you expect it to be. Support the radio you rely on. Make a gift at supportkuaf.com.
This is a Monday edition of Ozarks at Large, and that means it's time for a visit with Pete Hartman, the operations director at 91.3. Happy Monday, Peter.
You too.
Very good.
It's a beautiful one.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Autumn has arrived, and I think you have a Sunday special later this week that kind of fits the season.
That's right. You know, kind of we're in that the season of gratitude or of thankfulness. The Sunday special coming up Sunday, 3 p.m. It's called The Science of Gratitude. It's hosted by Susan Sarandon, and basically it's research, expert opinion, all about individual stories illustrating how gratitude either has a large impact or why it doesn't have a large impact. So that's going to be a neat hour again, Sunday at 3, and that's The Science of Gratitude.
All right.
Couple of things coming up this week. Today, Cynthia E. Smith, she's giving a gallery talk at noon, then a lecture this afternoon at 4:30 on the U of A campus. It's all part of the Faye Jones School of Architecture and Design series. She's curator of socially responsible design at the Smithsonian Design Museum. Now, that sounds like a pretty interesting job title.
Agreed.
Again, public talk at 4:30 if you'd like to know more, fayjones.uark.edu. The monthly COCO-C chapter of the Arkansas Archaeological Society meets tomorrow. They're going to have a neat topic. Jim Reese presenting, I believe it's Cato, right? Cato canteens?
Yes.
Okay. Cato canteens, or at least what for a while they've thought were water vessels, now turns out they might actually have been a musical device.
Oh.
More than, so
and
to me, that's...
I would assume that tomorrow we'll learn how they kind of transitioned.
No.
Transitioned from thinking it was a water vessel to a musical
instrument. And how long it took and stuff. And as you know, those take place at the Arkansas Archaeological Survey Building. And if you'd like to know more about that, try the community calendar at KUAF.com. Humane Society of the Ozarks, celebrating 73 years in Fayetteville. In fact, Mayor Lionel Jordan has proclaimed Thursday as Tales of Love Day, recognizing this group. That evening, they're also going to have their annual fundraiser. For more on that, hsozarks.org. And let's see, one more, Ruckus on the River. This is a fundraising event that will benefit the Buffalo National River, and it's taking place Thursday, 6:30 to 9 p.m. at Bear's Place in South Fayetteville. Yeah. Proceeds will go to efforts to protect the Buffalo National River. Again, more on that, it would be BuffaloRiverAlliance.org. But of course, any PSA you hear on KUAF or you hear about is probably on our community calendar at KUAF.com.
And when you say PSA, that is short.
Public Service Announcement.
There you go. What about Community Spotlight?
We actually spoke with members of the Humane Society of the Ozarks in preparation for Thursday's event. And actually, this segment really had more to do with the history, how this group started in Fayetteville, what urged these few families to make this decision. I thought it was pretty cool. Tomorrow, we're going to hear from representatives from Circle of Life Hospice. November is National Hospice Month. Then later this week, I'm actually talking to quite a few people. I don't know when these will air, but we're going to hear from a nonprofit out of Benton County, Pearl. They work directly with drug and veteran courts, and they're going to have a fundraising event coming up. Potluck Arts this month is doing their, again, they brought back the circus performances. We're going to talk to them. Going to speak with a Fayetteville High School student, Lexi Scott, about the annual homeless vigil that's coming up.
That's where Fayetteville High School students stay out all night in makeshift shelters.
And, you know, we as a community, we kind of sponsor them and they do this. And, you know, I've never done that, but I bet that would be an eye-opener.
Mm-hmm.
Then to wrap the week up, I'm going to interview Susan Eidlett. She's with Community Relations with Adventure Subaru. And we're going to talk about their annual Share the Love program and who it's going to benefit this year. So quite a bit coming up. And it's funny, I kind of went through this dry spell with interviews. But well, there's always that spell after Christmas or after summer and leading up through Halloween where we all, it seems like we
people getting back to
take
school,
a break,
right?
And then whammo. So lots of stuff going on.
And those interviews you mentioned that are taking place this week, those are community spotlights that we'll hear over the next couple of few weeks, right?
That's right. Yes.
Okay. Pete Hartman, Operations Director. He is also in charge of the community spotlight at KUAF. If people have an idea for community spotlight,
please do email me the best way. That's phartma@uark.edu.
All right, you get here early. Now go and enjoy the day.
I think I will.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Grace Brim of Bisco became known as a vocalist, drummer, and harmonica player in the male-dominated field of blues music in the mid-20th century, billed as the Queen of Harmonica. She was born Grace Millard in Bisco in southeastern Prairie County in July 1923 or 1924, sources vary. The Arkansawyer met her life partner and longtime musical partner in Gary, Indiana in 1945, bluesman John Brim of Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Grace and John Brim married in 1947 and gigged around Gary and beyond. They recorded with pianist Big Maceo Merriweather for Fortune Records of Detroit, Michigan in 1950 with Grace on vocals. The next year, Grace and John each had a release on Random Records of Chicago, Illinois.
I beg my baby not to stop a drinking way. Baby, Lord, you stop a drinking with. Boy, she gonna keep on drinking till she drive me far away.
Grace and John Brim are heard here, billed as John Brim and his trio from 1952 with pianist Sunnyland Slim. Grace Brim also recorded with her husband as John Brim and his Gary Kings, John Brim Trio, and John Brim and his Stompers, named for John's song, The Gary Stomp. They recorded as the John Brim Trio for J.O.B. Records of Chicago, which billed Grace as Queen of the Harmonica. She also appeared as Mrs. John Brim. The Prairie County native recorded with Snooky Pryor, Eddie Taylor, Jimmy Reed, and fellow Arkansas-er Roosevelt Sykes, among others.
God, he'll never do that no more.
Sometimes a babe needs something to keep you cool. Ah, now sometimes a babe needs something to keep you cool. Better look out now, though. Dave's got something for you. Tell you what it is.
Based in Gary, Indiana, the Brims had 9 children. Grace increasingly left the spotlight to her husband, John. The couple last appeared together on a single in the 1970s.
See, now all my flavors are guaranteed to satisfy. Hold on a second, baby. I gotta put my banana Dixie cups, all flavors and push-ups too. I'm your ice cream man, baby. Stop me when I'm passing by.
Grace and John Brim got an unexpected boost in the late 1970s when John's song Ice Cream Man appeared on Van Halen's album debut. The 1978 rock album has since sold millions of copies in the U.S. alone. While Grace played on her husband's original version of the song, it was deemed too risque for release at the time. Grace Brim died in 1999 in Gary, Indiana.
I usually come along just about 1 o'clock. Let me cool your baby.
Here in its entirety is Arkansas-er Grace Brim of Bisco, born Grace Millard in Prairie County, with Man Around My Door from 1952.
My door. That day.
Arkansas, your Grace Brim of Biscoe in Prairie County with Man Around My Door from 1952. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Executive producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs is underwritten by the Old Statehouse Museum in Little Rock, a museum of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. Arkansas since 1998.
The University of Arkansas cross-country teams will enter this weekend's NCAA championships as the SEC champs. The sixth-ranked women placed all seven runners in the top 15 places at the SEC meet Friday to win the title, the seventh consecutive conference title for the women. The 17th-ranked men captured the program's 37th conference crown, with three runners finishing in the top 10. The NCAA championships are Saturday morning in Louisville. The Arkansas soccer season is over after the Razorbacks lost to North Carolina State Saturday in the first round of the NCAA tournament. NC State won that 4-1. And the John Brown University women's soccer team is now waiting for an at-large bid to the NAIA championships after losing the Sooner Athletic Championship in double overtime this weekend. Number 23 Science and Arts defeated JBU in Siloam Springs Saturday.
On the next Fresh Air, Father Greg Boyle talks about his work as the founder of Homeboy Industries, cafes, bakeries, groceries, and diners that hire former East LA gang members and people released from prison to help them start new lives. We'll also talk about how and why he became a Jesuit priest and what it means to him to find God in all things. He's written a new memoir. Join us.
Tomorrow at 11 on 91.3. A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Siloam Springs. Siloam Springs, where the band The Sons of Otis Malone played their farewell concerts at 28 Springs Saturday night. We'll miss them, but best of luck to Ben as he moves east. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you again tomorrow.